snatched up her napkin to muffle what was plainly a laugh. It had been 25 years since she'd heard me say that. I gave her a look, but this was no time to be picking up the threads. "All right," I said, turning to face the young man again and taking a deep breath. "I better go with you to see the general." I got to my feet again, and only at this point realized that having been surprised whilst changing, I was still wearing nothing but my shift and dressing gown. "I'll help you dress," Jenny said, standing up hurriedly. She gave the soldier a charming smile and gestured at the table, now strewn with toast, marmalade, and a steaming dish of kippers. "Have a bite while you wait, lad. No point wasting good food." Jenny poked her head out into the corridor and listened, but the faint sound of a fork on china, and Mrs. Fig's voice from below, indicated that the soldier had accepted her suggestion. She quietly closed the door. "I'll go with you," she said. "The town's full of soldiers. You shouldn't go out by yourself." "I'll be..." I began, but then stopped, unsure. Most of the British officers in Philadelphia knew me as Lady John Grey, but that didn't mean that rank-and-file soldiers shared either that knowledge or the sense of respect that it normally engendered. I also felt like an imposter, but that was rather beside the point. It didn't show. "Thank you," I said abruptly. "I'd be glad of your company." Unsure as I felt about everything save my conviction that Jamie was coming, I was glad of a little moral support, though I wondered whether I might need to warn Jenny of the need for circumspection when I talked to General Clinton. "I shall just say a word myself," she assured me, grunting slightly as she pulled my laces tight. "Do you think you should tell him what's happened to Lord John?" "No, I definitely don't," I said, exhaling forcefully. "That's tight enough." "Hmm." She was already deep in the armoire, picking through my gowns. "What about this one? It's got a deep décolletage, and your bosom's still very good." "I'm not meaning to seduce the man." "Oh, yes, you are," she said matter-of-factly. "Or at least distract him. If you're no going to tell him the truth, I mean." One sleek black eyebrow lifted. If I were a British general and was told that my wee colonel had been abducted by a wicked great Heeland man, I think I might take it amiss. I couldn't really contradict this piece of reasoning, and with a brief shrug, wriggled my way into the amber silk, which had cream-coloured piping in the seams, and ruched cream ribbons outlining the edge of the bodice. "Oh, aye, that's good," Jenny said, tying my laces and stepping back to eye the effect with approval. "The ribbon's near the same colour as your skin, so the neck looks even lower than it is." "One would think you'd spent the last 30 years running a dressmaker's salon, or a brothel, rather than a farm," I remarked, nervousness making me rather cross. She snorted. "I've got 3 daughters, 9 granddaughters, and there's 60 nieces and great-nieces on Ian's sister's side. It's often much the same sort of thing." That made me laugh, and she grinned at me. Then I was blinking back tears, and so was she. The thought of Brianna and of Ian, our lost ones, coming suddenly. And then we were embracing, holding hard to each other to keep grief at bay. "It's all right," she whispered, hugging me fiercely. "You've not lost your lass. She's still alive. And Ian's still wi' me. He'll never go from my side." "I know," I said, choked. "I know." I let go and straightened up, smudging tears away with a finger, sniffing. "Have you got a handkerchief?" She had one in her hand, in fact, but reached into the pocket at her waist and pulled out another, freshly washed and folded, which she handed me. "I'm a granny," she said, and blew her nose vigorously. "I've always got a spare hanky. Or 3. Now what about your hair? You cannot be going out in the street like that." By the time we'd got my hair done up in something resembling order, corralled in a snood and pinned respectably under a broad-brimmed woven straw hat, I'd come up with at least a rough notion of what to tell General Clinton. Stick to the truth as far as possible. That was the first principle of successful lying, though it had been some time since I'd been last obliged to employ it. Well, then, a messenger had come for Lord John, one had, bringing a note. He did. I had no idea what was in the note. Totally true. Lord John had then left with the messenger, but without telling me where they were going. Also, technically true, the only variance being that it had been a different messenger. No, I hadn't seen in which direction they had gone. No, I didn't know whether they had walked or ridden. Lord John's saddle horse was kept at Davison's livery on Fifth Street, 2 blocks away. That sounded good. If General Clinton chose to make inquiries, I was reasonably sure he'd discover the horse still in its stall, and thus conclude that John was somewhere in the city. He would also presumably lose interest in me as a source of information, and send soldiers round to whatever haunts a man such as Lord John Grey might be supposed to be visiting. And with any luck at all, by the time the general had exhausted such possibilities as Philadelphia offered, John would be back and could answer his own damned questions.
"And what about Jamie?" Jenny asked,
her face showing small signs of anxiety. "He'll not come back into the city, surely?"
"I hope not."
I could scarcely draw breath, and not merely because of the tight lacing. I could feel the thudding of my heart against the placket of the stays. Jenny gave me a long, considering look. Eyes narrowed, and shook her head.
"No, you don't," she said.
"You think he'll come straight back here, for you?"
"And you're right. He will."
She considered for a moment longer, her brow furrowed. "I'd best stay here," she said abruptly. "Should he come back whilst you're with the General, he'll need to know what's the state of things. And I dinna think I trust her in the kitchen not to stab him wi' a toasting fork should he loom up in her doorway without notice." I laughed, all too easily envisioning Mrs. Figg's response to a sudden Highlander in her midst. "Besides," she added, "someone's got to clear up the mess. And I've had a good bit of practice with that, too." The young soldier greeted my belated reappearance with relief, and while not actually seizing my arm and hustling me down the pavement, offered me his own arm, and then walked in such a fashion that I was urged into a near trot to keep up with him. It was not far to the mansion where Clinton had made his headquarters, but the day was warm, and I arrived moist and gasping, with tendrils of hair escaping from under my straw hat and sticking to my neck and cheeks, and tendrils of sweat snaking their tickling slow way down inside my bodice. My escort delivered me, with an audible sigh of relief, to another soldier in the spacious parquet-floored foyer, and I had a moment to shake the dust from my skirts, straighten and repin my hat, and blot my face and neck discreetly with a ladylike lace hanky. I was sufficiently taken up with this that it was a moment before I recognised the man sitting on one of the little gilded chairs on the other side of the foyer.
"Lady John," he said, standing up when he saw that I had noticed him. "Your servant, ma'am."
He smiled slightly, though it lent no warmth at all to his eyes.
"Captain Richardson," I said flatly. "How nice."
I didn't offer my hand, and he didn't bow. There was no point in trying to pretend that we were anything but enemies, and not very cordial ones either. He'd precipitated my marriage to Lord John by inquiring of John whether he, John, had any personal interest in me, as he, Richardson, was contemplating my immediate arrest on grounds of spying and of passing seditious materials. Both charges were quite true, and while John might not have known that, he took Richardson's word regarding his intentions, told Richardson politely that no, there was no personal interest, also true as a statement, so far as it went, and 2 hours later
I was standing in his parlour in a daze of shock and grief, mechanically saying, "I do," in response to questions that I neither heard nor comprehended. I had barely heard Richardson's name at the time, let alone known him by sight. John had introduced me, with cold formality, when Richardson came up to us at the Miscianza, the huge ball thrown for the British officers by the Loyalist ladies of Philadelphia a month before. And only then had he told me about Richardson's threats, with a brief admonition to avoid the fellow. "Are you waiting to see General Clinton?" I inquired politely. If he was, I had half a mind to execute a quiet sneak through the house and out of the back door while he was ensconced with the general. "I am," he replied, adding graciously, "but you must certainly go before me, Lady John. My business will wait." That had a mildly sinister ring to it, but I merely inclined my head politely with a non-committal, It was dawning upon me, like an incipient case of indigestion, that my position with regard to the British Army in general, and Captain Richardson in particular, was on the verge of a marked re-evaluation. Once it became common knowledge that Jamie wasn't dead, then I was no longer Lady John Grey. I was Mrs. James Fraser again, and while that was certainly cause for ecstatic rejoicing, it also removed any restraint on Captain Richardson's baser urges. Before I could think of anything useful to say to the man, a lanky young lieutenant appeared to usher me into the general's presence. The drawing-room, which had been converted to Clinton's main office, was now in a state of organized disarray, with packing crates lining one wall and bare flagstaffs tied together like a bundle of faggots, the military banners they usually sported being folded briskly into tidy packets by a corporal near the window. I'd heard, the whole city had probably heard, that the British Army was withdrawing from Philadelphia. Evidently they were doing so with considerable dispatch. There were several other soldiers carrying things in and out, but two men were seated, one on either side of the desk. "Lady John," Clinton said, looking surprised, but rising from his desk and coming to bow over my hand. "Your most obedient servant, ma'am."
"Good day to you, sir," I said.
My heart had already been beating fast. It speeded up considerably at the sight of the man who had risen from his chair and was standing just behind the general. He was in uniform and looked strikingly familiar, but I was sure I'd never seen him before. "Who?"
"I am so sorry to have disturbed you, Lady John. I had hoped to surprise your husband," the general was saying, "but I understand that he's not at home."
No, he's not." The stranger, an infantry colonel, though his uniform seemed to sport even more gold lace than usual, raised a brow at this. The sudden familiarity of the gesture gave me a slight spinning sensation in the head. "You're a relative of Lord John Grey's," I blurted, staring at him. He had to be. The man wore his own hair, as John did, though his was dark beneath its powder. The shape of his head, fine-boned and long-skulled, was John's, and so was the set of his shoulders. His features were much like John's, too, but his face was deeply weathered and gaunt, marked with harsh lines carved by long duty and the stress of command. I didn't need the uniform to tell me that he was a lifelong soldier. He smiled, and his face was suddenly transformed. Apparently he had John's charm, too.
"You're most perceptive, madam," he said,
and stepping forward, smoothly took my limp hand away from the general and kissed it briefly in the continental manner before straightening and eyeing me with interest.
"General Clinton informs me that you are my brother's wife."
"Oh," I said, scrambling to recover my mental bearings. "Then you must be Hal. I beg your pardon. I mean, you're the... I'm sorry, I know you're a duke, but I'm afraid I don't recall your title, Your Grace."
"Pardlow," he said, still holding my hand and smiling at me. "But my Christian name is Harold. Do please use it if you like.
Welcome to the family, my dear. I had no idea John had married. I understand the event was quite recent.
He spoke with great cordiality, but I was aware of the intense curiosity behind his good manners.
Ah, I said noncommittally. Yes, quite recent.
It hadn't for an instant occurred to me to wonder whether John had written to tell his family about me. And if he had, they could barely have received the letter by now. I didn't even know who all the members of his family were, though I had heard about Hal, he being the father of John's nephew Henry, who...
Oh, of course! You've come to see Henry, I exclaimed. He'll be so pleased to see you. He's doing very well, I assured him.
I've already seen Henry, the Duke assured me in turn. He speaks with the greatest admiration of your skill in removing pieces of his intestine and reuniting the remnants. Though eager as I naturally was to see my son and my daughter.
His lips compressed for a moment. Apparently Dottie had informed her parents about her engagement,
and delighted as I shall be to meet my brother again, it is actually duty that called me to America. My regiment is newly landed in New York.
Oh, I said, how nice.
John plainly hadn't known that his brother, let alone his regiment, was coming. It occurred dimly to me that I ought to be asking questions and finding out what I could about the general's plans, but it didn't seem the time or place. The general coughed politely.
Lady John, do you happen to know the whereabouts of your husband at the moment?
The shock of meeting Harold, Duke of Pardlow, had quite wiped the reason for my presence out of my mind, but this brought it back with a rush.
No, I'm afraid I don't, I said, as calmly as possible.
I told your corporal. A messenger came a few hours ago with a note, and Lord John went off with him. He didn't say where he was going, though. The general's lips twitched.
Actually, he said, still polite, he didn't. Colonel Graves sent the messenger with a note informing Lord John of his recommission and directing him to come here at once. He didn't.
Oh, I said, sounding as blank as I felt. Under the circumstances, it seemed all right to let that show, and I did.
Dear me.
In that case, he did go off with someone.
But you don't know with whom.
I didn't see him go, I said, neatly avoiding the question. I'm afraid he didn't leave word as to where he was bound. Clinton raised a strongly marked black brow and glanced at Pardlow.
I suppose in that case he will return shortly, the Duke said with a shrug.
The matter isn't urgent after all.
General Clinton looked as though he differed somewhat with this opinion, but with a brief glance at me he said nothing. He clearly had little time to waste, though, and, bowing politely, bade me good day. I took my leave with alacrity, barely pausing to assure the Duke that I was pleased to have met him, and to ask where might his brother send word.
I have rooms at the King's Arms, Pardlow said.
Shall I? No, no, I said hurriedly, to forestall his offer to see me home. It's quite all right. Thank you, sir. I bowed to the general, then to Hal, and headed for the door in a whirl of skirts and emotions. Captain Richardson was no longer in the foyer, but I hadn't time to wonder where he had gone. I gave the soldier at the door a quick nod and smile, and then was out in the open air, breathing as though I'd just escaped from a bathysphere. Now what? I wondered, swerving to avoid two little boys with a hoop, who were caroming down the street, bouncing off the legs of the soldiers carrying parcels and furniture to a large wagon. The boys must belong to one of Clinton's officers, since the soldiers were tolerating them. John had spoken fairly often of his brother, and had remarked upon Hal's tendency toward ruthless high-handedness. All the current situation needed was a nosy Parker with a taste for authority mixing in. I wondered briefly whether William was on good terms with his uncle. If so, perhaps Hal could be diverted,
and put to good use in talking sense to... No, no, of course not. Hal mustn't know, yet at least, about Jamie, and he couldn't exchange two words with Willie without finding out. If William would talk about it, but then...
Lady John...
A voice behind me stopped me in my tracks, only momentarily, but long enough for the Duke of Pardlow to come up beside me. He took me by the arm, detaining me.
"You're a very bad liar," he remarked with interest. "What are you lying about, though, I wonder?"
"I do it better with a little warning," I snapped. "Though, as it happens, I'm not lying at the moment."
That made him laugh. He leaned closer, examining my face at close range. His eyes were pale blue, like John's, but the darkness of his brows and lashes gave them a particularly piercing quality.
"Perhaps not," he said, still looking amused. "But if you aren't lying, you aren't telling me everything you know, either."
"I'm not obliged to tell you anything I know," I said with dignity, trying to retrieve my arm. "Let go."
He did let go. Reluctantly.
"I beg your pardon, Lady John."
"Certainly," I said shortly, and made to go round him. He moved smartly in front of me, blocking my way.
"I want to know where my brother is," he said.
"I should like to know that myself," I replied, trying to sidle past him.
"Where are you going, may I ask?"
"Home."
It gave me an odd feeling still to call Lord John's house home. And yet I had no other.
"Yes, you do,"
a small, clear voice said in my heart.
"You have Jamie."
"Why are you smiling?" asked Pardlow, sounding startled.
"At the thought of getting home and taking off these shoes," I said hastily, erasing the smile. "They're killing me."
His mouth twitched a little.
"Allow me to offer you the use of my chair, Lady John."
"Oh, no, I really don't..."
But he had taken a wooden whistle from his pocket and uttered a piercing blast on it that brought two squat, muscular men, who had to be brothers, such was their resemblance to each other, trotting round the corner, a sedan chair suspended on poles between them.
"No, this isn't necessary at all," I protested. "Besides, John says you suffer from the gout. You'll need the chair yourself."
He didn't like that. His eyes narrowed and his lips compressed.
"I'll manage, madam," he said shortly,
and seizing me by the arm again, dragged me to the chair and pushed me inside, knocking my hat over my eyes as he did so.
"The lady is under my protection. Take her to the King's Arms," he instructed Tweedledum and Tweedledee, shutting the door.
And before I could say off with his head, we were jolting down the high street at a terrific pace.
I seized the door handle, intending to leap out, even at the cost of cuts and bruises. But the bastard had put the locking pin through the outside handle, and I couldn't reach it from the inside. I shouted at the chairmen to stop, but they ignored me completely, pounding along the cobbles as though bringing the news from X to Ghent. I sat back, panting and furious, and jerked the hat off. What did Pardlow think he was doing? From what John had said, and from other remarks made by the Duke's children about their father, it was clear to me that he was used to getting his own way. "Well, we'll bloody see about that," I muttered, stabbing the long pearl-headed hatpin through the hat brim. The snood that had contained my hair had come off with the hat. I crammed it inside and shook my loose hair out over my shoulders. We turned into Fourth Street, which was paved with brick rather than cobbles, and the jolting grew less. I was able to let go my grip on the seat and fumbled with the window. If I could get it open, I might be able to reach the locking pin, and even if the door flew open and decanted me into the street, it would put a stop to the Duke's machinations. The window worked on a sliding panel arrangement, but had no sort of latch by which to get a grip on it. The only way of opening it was by inserting the fingertips into a shallow groove at one side and pushing. I was grimly attempting to do this, in spite of the chair's renewed bucketing, when I heard the Duke's voice choke and stop in the midst of some shouted direction to the chairman.
Stop! I can't.
His words trailed off. The chairman faltered to a halt, and I pressed my face against the suddenly motionless window. The Duke was standing in the middle of the street, a fist pressed into his waistcoat, struggling to breathe. His face was deeply flushed, but his lips were tinged with blue.
"Put me down and open this bloody door this instant," I bellowed through the glass to one of the chairmen, who was glancing back over his shoulder, a look of concern on his face.
They did, and I emerged from the chair in an explosion of skirts, stabbing the hatpin down into the placket of my stays as I did so.
I might need it yet.
"Bloody sit down," I said, reaching Pardlow. He shook his head, but let me lead him to the chair where I forced him to sit. My feeling of satisfaction at this reversal of position, somewhat tempered by the fear that he might just possibly be about to die. My first thought, that he was having a heart attack, had vanished the moment I heard him breathe, or try to. The wheezing gasp of someone in the throes of an asthmatic attack was unmistakable, but I seized his wrist and checked his pulse just in case. Hammering, but steady, and while he was sweating, it was the normal warm perspiration caused by hot weather, rather than the sudden clammy exudation that often accompanied a myocardial infarction. I touched his fist, still embedded in his midsection. "Do you have pain here?" He shook his head, coughed hard, and took his hand away.
"Need pill,"
he managed. And I saw that there was a small pocket in the waistcoat that he'd been trying to reach into. I put in two fingers and pulled out a small enameled box, which proved to contain a tiny corked vial.
"What?"
"Never mind."
I pulled the cork, sniffed, and wheezed myself as the sudden fumes of ammonia shot up my nose.
"No,"
I said definitely, putting the cork back in and shoving vial and box into my pocket. "That won't help. Purse your lips and blow out." His eyes bulged a bit, but he did it. I could feel the slight movement of air on my own perspiring face.
"Right. Now, relax. Don't gasp for air. Just let it come. Blow out to the count of four. 1, 2, 3, 4. In for a count of two, same rhythm. Yes. Blow out. Count of four. Let it come in. Count of two. Yes, good. Now don't worry, you aren't going to suffocate. You can keep doing that all day."
I smiled encouragingly at him, and he managed to nod. I straightened up and looked round. We were near Locust Street, and Peterman's Ordinary was no more than a block away.
"You," I said to one of the chairmen, "run to the Ordinary and fetch back a jug of strong coffee. He'll pay for it," I added with a flip of the hand toward the Duke.
We were beginning to draw a crowd. I kept a wary eye out. We were near enough to Dr. Hebdy's surgery that he might come out to see the trouble. And the very last thing I needed was that charlatan to materialize. Fleam at the ready.
"You have asthma,"
I said, returning my attention to the Duke. I knelt so that I could see into his face while I monitored his pulse. It was better, noticeably slower, but I thought I could feel the odd condition called paradoxical pulse, a phenomenon you sometimes saw in asthmatics, wherein the heart rate speeded up during exhalation and dropped during inhalation. Not that I'd been in any doubt.
"Did you know that?"
He nodded, still pursing his lips and blowing.
"Yes,"
he managed briefly, before breathing in again.
"Do you see a doctor for it?"
A nod.
"And did he actually recommend salvolatile for it?"
I gestured towards the vial in my pocket. He shook his head.
"For fainting,"
he managed.
"All I had."
"Right." I put a hand under his chin and tilted his head back, examining his pupils, which were quite normal. I could feel the spasm easing, and so could he. His shoulders were beginning to drop,
and the blue tinge had faded from his lips. You don't want to use it when you're having an asthma attack. The coughing and tearing will make matters worse by producing phlegm.
Whatever are the idle lot of you doing standing about? Go run and fetch the doctor, lad!
I heard a woman's sharp voice say in the crowd behind me. I grimaced, and the Duke saw it. He raised his brows in question.
You don't want that, Doctor, believe me.
I stood up and faced the crowd, thinking, No, we don't need a doctor, thank you very much, I said, as charmingly as possible.
He's just been overtaken by the indigestion. Something he ate. He's quite all right now.
He don't look that good to me, ma'am, said another voice, doubtful. I think we best fetch the doctor.
Let him die, came a shout from the back of the gathering crowd. Fucking lobster.
An odd sort of shimmer ran through the crowd at this, and I felt a knot of dread form in my stomach. They hadn't been thinking of him as a British soldier, merely as a spectacle, but now...
I'll get the doctor, Lady John.
To my horror, Mr. Caulfield, a prominent Tory, had forced his way to the front, being tolerably free with his gold-headed walking stick.
Get away, you lice!
He bent to peer into the sedan chair, lifting his hat to Hal.
Your servant, sir. Help will be here presently, be assured of that.
I seized him by the sleeve. The crowd was, thank God, divided. While there were catcalls and insults directed at Pardlow and at me, there were dissenting voices too, those of loyalists, or perhaps merely the saner sorts, who didn't think attacking a sick man in the street part of their political philosophy.
Chiming in, with reason, protests,
and not a few loud insults of their own.
No, no, I said. Let someone else go for the doctor, please. We daren't leave His Grace here without protection.
His Grace?
Caulfield blinked, and carefully unfolding his gold-rimmed pince-nez from a little case, put them on his nose and bent to peer into the chair at Pardlow, who gave him a small dignified nod, though he kept on assiduously with his breathing exercise.
The Duke of Pardlow, I said hastily, still keeping a grip of Mr. Caulfield's sleeve. Your Grace, may I present Mr. Phineas Graham Caulfield?
I waved a vague hand between them. Then, spotting the chairman coming back at the gallop with a jug, I sprinted toward him, hoping to reach him before he got within earshot of a crowd.
Thank you, I said, panting as I snatched the jug from him.
We've got to get him away before the crowd turns nasty.
Nastier, I amended, hearing a sharp crack as a thrown pebble bounced off the roof of the sedan chair.
Mr. Caulfield ducked.
Oi! Shouted the chairman, infuriated at this attack upon his livelihood. Back off, you lot!
He started for the crowd, fists clenched, and I seized him by the coattails with my free hand.
Get him and your chair away, I said, as forcefully as possible. Take him to...
Not the King's Arms. It was a known loyalist stronghold, and would merely inflame anyone who followed us. Neither did I want to be at the Duke's mercy once inside the place.
Take us to number 17 Chestnut Street, I said hurriedly,
and digging one-handed in my pocket, grabbed a coin and thrust it into his hand.
Now!
He didn't pause for thought, but took the coin and headed for the chair at the run, fists still clenched, and I trotted after him as fast as my red Morocco heels would take me, clutching the coffee. His number was stitched into a band around his sleeve. 39. A shower of pebbles was rattling off the sedan chair's sides, and the second chairman, number 40, was batting at them as though they were a swarm of bees, shouting, "Fuck off!" at the crowd, in a businesslike, if repetitious, fashion. Mr. Caulfield was backing him up in a more genteel fashion, shouting,
"Away with you!" and "Leave off at once,"
punctuated with pokes of his cane at the more daring children who were darting forward to see the fun.
"Here," I gasped, leaning into the chair.
Hal was still alive, still breathing. He raised one brow at me and nodded toward the crowd outside. I shook my head and thrust the coffee into his hands.
"Drink that," I managed,
and keep breathing. Slamming the door of the chair, I dropped the locking pin into its slot with an instant satisfaction, and straightened up to find Fergus's eldest son, Germaine, standing by my side.
"Have you got a bit of trouble started again, grand-mère?"
he asked, unperturbed by the stones, now augmented with clumps of fresh manure whizzing past our heads.
"You might say so, yes," I said. "Don't."
But before I could speak further, he turned round and bellowed at the crowd in a surprisingly loud voice.
"This is my granny. You touch one hair on her head, and..."
Several people in the crowd laughed at this, and I put up a hand to my head. I'd completely forgotten the loss of my hat, and my hair was standing out in a mushroom-like cloud around my head, what wasn't sticking to my sweating face and neck.
"And I'll do you brown," Germaine yelled. "Aye. I mean you, Shecky Low, and you too, Joe Groom."
Two half-grown boys hesitated, clumps of filth in hand. Evidently they knew Germaine.
"And my granny'll tell your da what you've been a-doing too."
That decided the boys, who stepped back a pace, dropping their clods of dirt and trying to look as though they had no idea where they had come from.
"Come on, grand-mère,"
Germaine said, grabbing my hand. The chairmen, no slouches on the uptake, had already seized their poles and hoisted the chair. I'd never managed to keep up with them in the high-heeled shoes. As I was kicking them off, I saw plump Dr. Hebdy puffing down the street in the wake of a hectoring woman who had suggested calling him, and who was now sailing towards us on the breeze of her heroism, face set in triumph.
"Thank you, Mr. Caulfield," I said hurriedly,
and snatching up the shoes in one hand, followed the chair, unable to keep my skirts up off the grubby cobbles, but not terribly concerned about that. Germaine fell back a little, making threatening gestures to discourage pursuit, but I could tell from the sound of the crowd that their momentary hostility had turned to amusement, and though further catcalls followed us, no missiles came in their wake. The chairmen slowed a little once we'd turned the corner, and I was able to make headway on the flat brick of Chestnut Street, coming up beside the chair. Hal was peering through the side window, looking considerably better. The coffee jug was on the seat beside him, evidently empty.
"Where are we going, madam?" he shouted through the window when he saw me.
So far as I could tell, over the steady thump of the chairman's shoes and the glass of the window, he sounded much better, too.
"Don't worry, Your Grace," I shouted back, jogging along. "You're under my protection."
Chapter 7. The Unintended Consequences of Ill-Considered Actions. Jamie shoved through the brush, heedless of ripping brambles and slapping branches.
Anything that got in his way could get out of it, or be trampled.
He hesitated for no more than an instant when he reached the two horses, hobbled and grazing. He untied them both, and, slapping the mare, sent her snorting into the brush. Even if no one made off with the extra horse before the militia let John Gray go, Jamie didn't mean to make it easy for the man to get back to Philadelphia. Whatever must be dealt with there would be done much more easily without the complications of his lordship's presence.
"And what would be done?" he wondered,
nudging his heels into his horse's sides and reining its head round toward the road. He noticed with some surprise that his hands were shaking, and squeezed hard on the leather to make it stop. The knuckles of his right hand throbbed, and a white stab of pain where his missing finger had been ran through his hand, making him hiss through his teeth.
"What the devil did you tell me for, you wee idiot?"
he said under his breath, urging his horse up into a gallop.
"What did you think I'd do?"
"Just what you damn well did," was the answer.
John hadn't resisted, hadn't fought back.
"Go ahead and kill me," the wee bugger had said.
A fresh spurt of rage curled Jamie's hands as he imagined all too well doing just that. Would he have gone ahead and done it if that pissant Woodbine and his militia hadn't turned up?
No, he wouldn't.
Even as he longed momentarily to go back and choke the life out of Grey, he was beginning to answer his own question, reason fighting its way through the haze of fury. Why had Grey told him? There was the obvious. The reason he'd hit the man by sheer reflex. The reason he was shaking now. Because Grey had told him the truth.
"We were both fucking you."
He breathed hard and deep, fast enough to make him giddy. But it stopped the shaking, and he slowed a little. His horse's ears were laid back, twitching in agitation.
"It's all right then, Ian," he said,
still breathing hard, but slower now.
"It's all right."
He thought for a moment that he might vomit, but managed not to, and settled back in the saddle, steadier. He could still touch it, that raw place Jack Randall had left on his soul. He'd thought it so well scarred over that he was safe now. But no, bloody John Grey had torn it open with five words. "We were both fucking you." And he couldn't blame him for it. Oughtn't to, anyway, he thought, reason doggedly fighting back the fury. Though he knew only too well how weak a weapon reason was against that spectre. Grey couldn't have known what those words had done to him. Reason had its uses, though. It was reason that reminded him of the second blow. The first had been blind reflex. The second wasn't. Thought of it brought anger, too, and pain, but of a different sort.
"I have had carnal knowledge of your wife." "You bugger," he whispered, clutching the reins with a reflexive violence that made the horse jerk its head, startled. "Why? Why did you tell me that, you bugger?"
And the second answer came belatedly, but as clearly as the first.
"Because she'd tell me, the minute she had a chance, and he kent that fine." He thought, "If I do violence when I hurt, best I do it to him." "Aye, she would have told him," he swallowed, "and she will tell me. What might he say or do when she did?"
He was trembling again and had slowed inadvertently, so the horse was nearly at a walk, head turning from side to side as it snuffed the air.
"It's nae her fault. I know that. It's nae her fault." They'd thought him dead. He knew what that abyss looked like. He'd lived there for a long while, and he understood what desperation and strong drink could do. But the vision, or the lack of one, how did it happen? Where? Knowing it had happened was bad enough. Not knowing the how and the why of it from her was almost unbearable.
The horse had stopped. The reins hung slack. Jamie was sitting in the middle of the road, eyes closed, just breathing, trying not to imagine, trying to pray. Reason had limits. Prayer didn't. It took a little while for his mind to relax its grip, its wicked curiosity, its lust to know. But after a bit, he felt he could go on, and gathered up the reins again. All that could wait. But he needed to see Claire before he did anything else. Just now he had no idea what he would say or do when he saw her. But he needed to see her, with the same sort of need that a man might feel who'd been cast away at sea, marooned without food or water for weeks on end. John Grey's blood was thrumming in his ears so loudly that he barely heard the discussion among his captors, who, having taken the elementary precautions of searching him and tying his hands together in front of him, had gathered into a knot a few yards away and were heatedly hissing at one another like geese in a barnyard, casting occasional hostile glares in his direction. He didn't care. He couldn't see out of his left eye, and he was by now quite certain that his liver was ruptured, but he didn't care about that either. He'd told Jamie Fraser the truth, the whole bloody truth,
and felt the same fierce constellation of feelings that attends victory in battle. The bone-deep relief of being alive. The giddy surge of emotion that carries you on a wave much like drunkenness. Then ebbs and leaves you staggering light-headed on the beach, and an absolute inability to count the cost till later. His knees experienced much the same post-battle sensations, and gave way. He sat down unceremoniously in the leaves and closed his good eye. After a short interval in which he was aware of nothing much beyond the gradual slowing of his heart, the thrumming noise in his ears began to abate, and he noticed that someone was calling his name.
"Lord Grey," the voice said again, louder, and closer enough that he felt a warmly fetid gust of tobacco-laden breath on his face. "My name is not Lord Grey," he said rather crossly, opening his eye. "I told you." "You said you were Lord John Grey," his interlocutor said, frowning through a mat of grizzled facial hair. It was a large man in the filthy hunting shirt who had first discovered him with Fraser. "I am. If you bloody have to talk to me, call me my lord, or just sir, if you like. What do you want?"
The man reared back a little, looking indignant.
"Well, since you ask, sir, first off, we want to know if this elder brother of yours is Major General Charles Grey."
"No."
"No?"
The man's unkempt eyebrows drew together.
"Do you know Major General Charles Grey? Is he kin to you?"
"Yes, he is. He's..."
Grey tried to calculate the precise degree, but gave it up and flapped a hand.
"Cousin of some sort."
There was a satisfied rumble from the faces now peering down at him. The man called Woodbine squatted down next to him, a square of folded paper in his hand.
"Lord John," he said, more or less politely, "you said that you don't hold an active commission in His Majesty's Army at present."
"That's correct."
Grey fought back a sudden, unexpected urge to yawn. The excitement in his blood had died away now, and he wanted to lie down.
"Then would you care to explain these documents, my lord? We found them in your breeches."
He unfolded the papers carefully and held them under Grey's nose. John peered at them with his working eye. The note on top was from General Clinton's adjutant. A brief request for Grey to attend upon the general at his earliest convenience.
Yes, he'd seen that, though he'd barely glanced at it before the cataclysmic arrival of Jamie Fraser, risen from the dead, had driven it from his mind.
Despite what had occurred in the meantime, he couldn't help smiling. Alive. The bloody man was alive. Then Woodbine took the note away, revealing the paper beneath. The document that had come attached to Clinton's note. It was a small piece of paper, bearing a red wax seal, and instantly identifiable. It was an officer's warrant, his proof of commission, to be carried on his person at all times. Grey blinked at it in simple disbelief, the spidery clerk's writing wavering before his eyes. But written at the bottom, below the king's signature, was another, this one executed in a bold, black, all-too-recognisable scrawl.
"How?" he exclaimed. "You bastard!"
"Told you he was a soldier,"
the small man with the cracked spectacles said, eyeing Grey from under the edge of his knitted kill hat, with an avidity that Grey found very objectionable.
"Not just a soldier, neither. He's a spy. Why, we could hang him out of hand this very minute."
There was an outburst of noticeable enthusiasm for this course of action, quelled with some difficulty by Corporal Woodbine, who stood up and shouted louder than the proponents of immediate execution, until those espousing it reluctantly fell back, muttering. Grey sat clutching the commission crumpled in his bound hands, heart hammering.
They bloody could hang him.
Howe had done just that to a Continental captain named Hale not 2 years before,
when Hale was caught gathering intelligence while dressed as a civilian, and the rebels would like nothing better than a chance to retaliate. William had been present, both at Hale's arrest and his execution, and had given Grey a brief account of the matter, shocking in its starkness.
William. Jesus, William!
Caught up in the immediacy of the situation, Grey had had barely a thought to spare for his son. He and Fraser had absquatulated onto the roof and down a drainpipe, leaving William clearly reeling with the shock of revelation, alone in the upstairs hallway. No, not alone. Claire had been there, and the thought of her steadied him a bit. She would have been able to talk to Willie, calm him, explain, well, possibly not explain, and possibly not calm either. But at least if Grey was hanged in the next few minutes, William wouldn't be left to face things entirely alone. "We're taking him back to camp," Woodbine was saying doggedly, not for the first time. "What good would it do to hang him here?"
"One less red coat seems like a good thing to me," riposted the burly thug in the hunting shirt. "Now, Gershon, I'm not saying as how we shouldn't hang him. I said not here and now."
Woodbine, musket held in both hands, looked slowly round the circle of men, fixing each one with his gaze.
"Not here, not now," he repeated.
Grey admired Woodbine's force of character, and narrowly kept himself from nodding agreement.
"We're taking him back to camp. You all heard what he said. Major General Charles Grey's kin to him.
Might be as Colonel Smith will want to hang him in camp. Or might even be as he'll want to send this man to General Wayne. Remember Paoli? Remember Paoli?"
Ragged cries echoed the call, and Grey rubbed at his swollen eye with his sleeve. Tears were leaking from it and irritating his face.
Paoli? What the devil was Paoli?
And what had it to do with whether, when, or how he should be hanged? He decided not to ask at just this moment, and when they hauled him to his feet, went along with them without complaint. Chapter 8. Homo est obligamus aerobe. Man is an obligate aerobe. Hippocrates. The Duke's face was dangerously flushed when Number 39 ceremoniously opened the sedan chair's door, and not, I thought, from the heat. "You wanted to see your brother, did you not?" I inquired, before he could gather enough breath to say any of the things on his mind. I gestured toward the house. "This is his house." The fact that John was not presently in the house could wait. He gave me a marked look, but he was still short of breath, and wisely saved it, irritably waving off Number 40's helping hand as he struggled out of the sedan chair. He did pay the chairmen, rather fortunate as I hadn't any more money with me, and, wheezing, bowed, offered me his arm. I took it, not wanting him to fall on his face in the front garden. Germaine, who had kept up with the chair without noticeable effort, followed at a tactful distance. Mrs. Fig was standing in the front doorway, watching our approach with interest. The broken door was now lying on a pair of trestles next to a camellia bush, having been removed from its hinges, and was presumably awaiting some sort of professional attention. "May I present Mrs. Mortimer Fig, Your Grace?" I said politely, with a nod in her direction. "Mrs. Fig is his lordship's cook and housekeeper." "Mrs. Fig, this is His Grace, the Duke of Pardlow, Lord John's brother." I saw her lips form the words, "Mared on toast," but fortunately without sound. She moved nimbly down the steps, despite her bulk, and took Hal by the other arm, shoring him up as he was beginning to turn blue again. "Purse your lips and blow," I said shortly. "Now." He made an ugly choking noise, but did start blowing, though making evil grimaces in my direction. "What in the name of the everlasting Holy Ghost did you do to him?" Mrs. Fig asked me accusingly. "Sounds like he's about to die." "Saved his life to start with," I snapped. "Upsy-daisy, Your Grace.
and between us we hoiked him up the steps. Then I saved him from being stoned and beaten by a mob, with Germaine's invaluable help, I added, glancing back at Germaine, who grinned hugely. I was also in the act of abducting him, but I thought we needn't go into that. And I'm about to save his life again, I think, I said, pausing on the porch to pant for a moment myself. Have we a bedroom we can put him in? Williams, perhaps?
Will,
the Duke began, but then started to cough spasmodically, going a nasty shade of puce. Oh, I was forgetting, I said. Of course. William's your nephew, isn't he? He's not here just now. I looked narrowly at Mrs. Fig, who snorted briefly but said nothing. Blow, Your Grace. Inside, I saw that some progress had been made toward restoring order. The debris had been swept into a neat pile by the open doorway, and Jenny Murray was sitting on an ottoman beside it, picking unbroken crystals from the fallen chandelier out of the rubbish and dropping them into a bowl. She lifted an eyebrow at me, but rose unhurriedly to her feet, putting the bowl aside. "What do you need, Claire?" she said. "Boiling water," I said, grunting slightly as we manoeuvred Pardlow. He was lean and fine-boned like John, but a solid man, nonetheless, into a winged chair. "Mrs. Fig, cups, several cups, and Jenny, my medicine chest. Don't lose your rhythm, Your Grace. Blow, 2, 3, 4, don't gasp. Sip the air. You'll get enough, I promise." Hal's face was twitching, shining with sweat, and while he still had control over himself, I could see panic creasing the lines around his eyes as his airways closed. I fought down a similar sense of panic. It wouldn't serve either of us. The fact was that he could die. He was having a severe asthmatic attack, and even with access to epinephrine injections and the facilities of a major hospital, people did die in such circumstances, whether of a heart attack brought on by stress and lack of oxygen, or from simple suffocation. His hands were clenched on his knees, the moleskin breeches crumpled and dark with sweat, and the cords of his neck stood out with strain. With some difficulty I pried one of his hands loose and grasped it strongly in mine. I had to distract him from the panic darkening his mind if he was to have any chance at all. "Look at me," I said, leaning close and looking straight into his eyes. "It's going to be all right. Do you hear me? Nod if you can hear me." He managed a short nod. He was blowing, but too fast. No more than a wisp of air touched my cheek. I squeezed his hand. "Slower," I said, my voice as calm as I could make it. "Breathe with me now. Purse your lips. Blow." I tapped out a regular count of 4 on his knee with my free hand, as slow as I dared. He ran out of air between 2 and 3, but kept his lips pursed, straining. "Slow," I said sharply, as his mouth opened, gasping, starved for air. "Let it come by itself. 1, 2, blow." I could hear Jenny hurrying down the stairs with my medicine chest. Mrs. Fig had departed like a great rushing wind in the direction of the cookhouse where she kept a cauldron boiling. Yes, here she came, 3 teacups looped over the fingers of one hand, a can of hot water wrapped in a towel clutched to her bosom with the other. 3, 4, joint fur, Jenny. 1, 2, blow out. 2, 3, 4, a good handful in each cup. 2, yes, that's it. Blow. Still holding his gaze, willing him to blow, it was all that was keeping his airways open. If he lost his rhythm, he'd lose what little air pressure he had, the airways would collapse, and then,
I shoved the thought aside, squeezing his hand as hard as I could, and gave disjointed directions between chanting the rhythm.
Joint fur. What the bloody hell else did I have?
Not much was the answer. Bowman's root, Jimson weed, much too dangerously toxic and not fast enough.
Spikenard, Jenny, I said abruptly. The root, grind it.
I pointed at the second cup, then the third. 2, 3, 4. A large handful of crumbled joint fur, aptly named, it looked like a pile of miniature sticks, had been placed in each cup and was already steeping. I'd give him the first as soon as it had cooled enough to drink, but it took a good half hour of steeping to get a truly effective concentration. More cups, please, Mrs. Fig. In. 1, 2.
That's good.
The hand in mine was slick with sweat, but he was gripping me with all the strength he had. I could feel my bones grind and twisted my hand a bit to ease them. He saw and released the pressure a little. I leaned in, cradling his hand in both of mine, not incidentally taking the opportunity to get my fingers on his pulse. "You aren't going to die," I said to him quietly, but as forcefully as I could. "I won't let you." The flicker of something much too faint to be a smile passed behind those winter-sharp blue eyes, but he hadn't enough breath even to think of speaking. His lips were still blue, and his face paper-white in spite of the temperature. The first cup of joint fur tea helped briefly, the heat and moisture doing as much as the herb. Joint fur did contain epinephrine, and was the only really good treatment for asthma I had available. But there wasn't enough of the active principle in a cup of the stuff after only 10 minutes brewing. Even the momentary sense of relief steadied him, though. His hand turned, fingers linking with mine, and he squeezed back. A fighter. I knew one when I saw one, and smiled involuntarily. Start 3 more cups, please, Jenny. If he drank them slowly, and he couldn't do more than sip briefly between gasps, and continuously, we should have got a decent amount of stimulant into him by the end of the 6th, most concentrated cup. And Mrs. Fig, if you would boil 3 handfuls of the joint fur and half that of spikenard in a pint of coffee for 1/4 hour, then let it steep. If he wasn't going to die, I wanted a concentrated tincture of ephedra easily on hand. This obviously wasn't his first attack. And if it wasn't his last, there'd be another sometime. And quite possibly, sometime soon. The back of my mind had been ticking through diagnostic possibilities, and now that I was fairly sure he was going to survive the moment, I could spare time to think about them consciously. Sweat was pouring down the fine-cut bones of his face. I'd got his coat, waistcoat, and leather stock off first thing, and his shirt front was pasted to his chest, his breeches black wet in the creases of his groin. No wonder, though, between the heat of the day, his exertions, and the hot tea. The blue tinge was fading from his lips, and there was no sign of edema in his face or hands, no distension of the blood vessels in his neck in spite of his effort. I could hear the crackling rails in his lungs easily without a stethoscope, but he showed no thoracic enlargement. His torso was as trim as John's, a bit narrower through the chest. Probably not a chronic obstructive pulmonary condition then. And I didn't think he had congestive heart failure. His colour, when I met him, had been good, and his pulse was presently thumping against my fingers very steadily, fast, but no flutters, no arrhythmia. I became aware of Germain hovering by my elbow, staring interestedly at the Duke, who was now sufficiently himself as to lift an eyebrow in the boy's direction, though still unable to speak. "I said, before resuming my now automatic counting of